wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. It's after Christmas, so a Happy New Year. It's almost 2024 and a Happy New Year. I wish you an after Christmas. We wish you an after Christmas. I wish you an after Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Well, hello there.
Welcome to He Saw, She Saw.
I am Corey.
And I am Keith.
And we love movies.
Just not the same ones.
So each episode, we make the other one watch a movie that we love.
And the other would never watch unless we were doing a podcast.
And then we talk about it. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
There's been a whole entire year of goings on.
It's been mostly good stuff, though. We're both teachers, and Corey is getting to teach a new grade.
Sorry, I was having a buzz in my ear. Apparently, Santa's here?
Ho, ho, ho.
Oh, Santa's here.
Oh, wow.
Merry Christmas.
Oh, Merry Christmas,
Merry
Santa.
Merry Christmas, Santa. Thank you. We love you, Santa.
Are we getting presents or are we getting coal? We're getting the silent treatment.
What's happening? So anyway, I've been teaching fifth grade.
Yes.
Inexplicably.
And you're doing a great job at it.
I don't know. I'm just kind of crashing my way through the year.
Oh, you're doing great.
Real overwhelmed. Don't have a lot of extra time. The extra time I spend is on the floor, sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
In the fetal position.
Wish we were joking. It's a lot, but you're doing a really good job. It's really hard to teach elementary school, and especially, you know, I mean, you've got your teaching degree and all that, and you're an incredible English and drama teacher, so,
thanks.
But learning to do it for fifth graders,
and
you've got a beach in your classroom. And
I do have the beach. I have a blue rug. It's mm-hmm. very fluffy, and then I have two beach chairs because I didn't want to fork over the cash for a bean bag chair because it was like $60. They have lemons on them. They don't really go with my whole like classroom theme because my classroom theme is the galaxy.
I know, but you love lemons.
But so I love lemons, and sometimes kids just want to lay on the rug.
Oh, to be 10.
Is that how old they are?
Yeah, fifth grade.
Fifth grade. So it's Christmas. Mm-hmm. We're going to go for Christmas movies.
Non-traditional Christmas movies.
One of the options was Eyes Wide Shut, basically a porno
mm-hmm.
set at Christmas time.
That was my original idea for a Christmas movie. Darn, it was taken.
A Kubrick porno?
Yeah, no, that's... So we didn't do Eyes Wide Shut.
You were looking at a website that had non-traditional Christmas movies.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because I...
Well, are we actually going to tell the truth here?
Oh, what?
What often happens
what
here
happened?
Is Corey just decides, you're going to see this movie now.
It's time.
And then it's my job to go backwards and figure out, okay, what could be the theme? What could be the movie to partner with this? So Corey was like, no, we're watching Better Off Dead. You need to see that movie. Like we've had the Darjeeling, is that how you say it?
Darjeeling.
Limited. And like.
On the docket.
Brothers Bloom on the docket.
For a year.
Dying to do this. And no, we're going to see Better Off
Dead. But it's Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a Christmas movie.
Mm-hmm. I went through a list of non-traditional Christmas movies. And there was one that Corey had never seen, which is, of course, Gremlins.
I have never seen it.
I
was not allowed.
Yeah, it's a one-hitter quitter for me. So I saw it. I saw it once in the theaters, but it's funny. I actually talk about Gremlins every year with my students because it is the first movie trailer I ever remember seeing in the theaters, which is for Rocky IV. And so when I try to explain the Cold War mm-hmm. and what it was like to grow up during the Cold War, I literally show them that Rocky preview.
Oh, because we were around and like sentient during the end of the Cold War.
Exactly. So. Oh. Yeah, I think it's Rocky IV. It's either Rocky III or Rocky IV, but it's the...
With Dolph Lundgren?
Yes, the I am Ivan Drago.
I don't remember.
And like that preview, like seared in my mind, and is the ultimate way to like explain to ninth graders, hey, this is what it was like in the Cold War.
Is Dolph Lundgren in the Hobbit movies?
No.
Who's in the Lord of the Rings movies that I'm thinking of? Not Dolph Lundgren. Viggo Mortensen. They have the same name.
No.
The same type of name.
What?
Did you ever see that movie with Viggo Mortensen and Diane Lane where he's like a dress, he's like a traveling dress guy, and it's like in the 50s. Everybody in New York City like goes to the Adirondacks or whatever to camp, and all the like wives like stay there all week. long. And the husbands come on the weekends, and she has an affair with Viggo Mortensen.
Well, as soon as you said Viggo and Diane Lane, I knew where it was going. What? But, what does that mean? Oh, come on. Those two, I mean, the sexual chemistry between those two would be off the charts.
I mean, obviously. Liv Schreiber plays her husband.
Huh.
And she cheats on him with Viggo Mortensen, the dress guy.
Well, I guess that's going to be a future episode. We'll watch that and we'll watch Eastern Promises, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, which you're absolutely going to hate. Now, does Viggo wear dresses or is this?
No, he has a bus with dresses and he comes to the campsite and all the housewives go. It's in the 50s and they all try on dresses. He has a hat.
Is he like very granola or something? Or?
Yeah, he's kind of granola. He's kind of like the lady in Matilda, but he's a guy and it's not books, it's dresses.
Wow. I'm pretty sure if you wanted to know which one of our episodes with the least amount of people, I'm pretty sure it's Eastern Promises and Diane Lane sleeps with the dress guy. I think that would be our low.
Okay. So maybe not.
Let's watch movies.
Ready? Okay. We watched Better Off Dead last night. We had our child in the room with us.
I was like, are you sure we should have our daughter in the room for this movie? And then about 10 minutes in, I paused it. And I was like, I really don't think we should have.
She wasn't paying attention, but then she started paying attention.
Yeah.
She was a little bothered.
How did it hold up?
Well, on that note, oftentimes I find myself in situations where I'm like, yeah, we got to watch this movie. And then we watch it and I go, oh, God, can we do something else? It's one of the cases where I forgot. I mean, it's called Better Off Dead. What?
Mm-hmm.
Not too cool with all the suicidal, was it ideation? Is mm-hmm. that what they call it?
Yeah.
Yeah, just that's what we poked fun at in the 80s.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's pretty dangerous to market that towards teenagers in this day and age.
Well, to be fair, it was actually a marketing issue at the time, too. They had, like, poster runs, and they had an original tagline. And then they were forced to make new taglines and new posters mm-hmm. where basically it was saying, like, no, you're never better off dead, you know, instead of the actual premise of the movie. Because it has not only ideations, but he actually goes through with several, albeit failed incredibly lame attempts that don't work, spoiler for the rest of the movie. Yeah, it's not
he survives, guys.
It's nothing to joke about. So
no, and I would say that maybe this movie didn't hold up very well.
Do you know why the movie is infamous, actually, is where I should start, beyond the incredibly weird marketing campaign behind it?
Yes, I do want to know.
So Savage Steve Holland, who wrote and directed this movie, was basically just a kid out of college who got super lucky with a student film and Henry Winkler, the Fonz.
Yeah.
Hey. Saw a huge amount of potential with him. And so just a few months after graduating college, he found himself with an office on the Paramount lot making movies. They basically signed him to a two-picture deal. He makes the first movie and then immediately moves into making the second movie, both with John Cusack. They do an advanced screening for Better Off Dead. Evidently, John Cusack hasn't been watching any of the dailies because he gets up and storms out of the advanced screening.
Uh-huh.
And Savage Steve races after him. And John turns around and tells him, that is the worst thing I have ever seen. You have completely tricked me, and I never want you to speak to me again. They were in the middle of filming a second movie called One Crazy Summer. I can imagine how fun that
the rest of that shoot was.
That's
funny because I often in my head confuse scenes from One Crazy Summer with Better Off Dead. And maybe I was thinking of One Crazy Summer like intertwined with it.
To be fair now, before we go into it, John Cusack was doing an AMA, Ask Me Anything on Reddit or something somewhere.
Is that what AMA means?
Yeah, Ask Me Anything.
I thought it was when you eat on a microphone.
No. That's ASMR. So that's when you are listening to some sort of comforting sound.
That makes more sense.
Like
also, I don't
mouth
think
noises.
Eating cereal is not a comforting sound.
No, I've never heard of that. So John Cusack had an AMA.
Okay.
Where somebody asked him and said, hey, do you still hate Better Off Dead? And John's answer was that he doesn't hate it. He still wishes there were several things that were very different about the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But in fairness, that is what he believes about all of his movies. And so he was glad that people still love the movie. Was that just a diplomatic answer, or did he actually believe that?
Well, you know, Danny Trejo has said that John Cusack is the scariest man in show business.
Oh, the Danny Trejo. Not Trejo, but the Trejo.
Sorry. Danny Trejo.
Trejo,
yes. I'm sorry.
Everything I have heard about Danny is he is very cool and he would understand.
Do you have a pitch for this movie?
Yes. Easiest one ever.
Oh.
When a teen loses his girlfriend to a jock, he wonders if he's better off dead. So we open in a room with pictures of a pretty teen girl. A lot of pictures. When the clock radio rings, which is how us old people in the 80s used to wake up, we should be shocked to find out, oh, no, this isn't the family room of some family. This is actually John Cusack's bedroom, who is sleeping next to a black and white headshot of this pretty teen girl. His name is Lane. He sleepishly makes his way to the bathroom to get ready, and he decides to wear his socks in the shower. Just to give you some character insight.
It's like wearing jeans in the ocean.
Very similar. There's a level of laziness that certain teen boys get to. Wearing socks in the shower would be one of them. We then cut to his parents' room, where Lane's father suddenly wakes up, sensing that their paper boy is racing towards the house. He is moving at great speed towards the house. The father races out wearing his wife's pink slippers and some sort of lingerie robe.
It's funny.
It tries. And so he races outside and is desperately trying to open his garage door. He struggles and he gets the garage door barely open as the paper boy throws the paper. And we see that every other window on the garage door is broken. He gets it up just in time and says, ha! He basically lets go of the garage door and it falls and boom, the last window of the garage door is also broken. He comes back into the kitchen where we meet Lane's mother. It's never addressed, but she looks way closer to Lane in age than the father. And it was so bad, I looked it up. And she is only 5 years younger than the dad.
They mom her up, though.
They definitely mom her up. But anyway, she plays a hopeless housewife who is just very ditzy and can't cook anything to save her life.
She's a space cookie.
Yeah, so she ruined bacon, which I didn't realize was possible. The dad tries to eat the bacon, can't. So he goes to the pantry to get out some cereal. He goes through like 3 or 4 boxes of cereal. Every cereal box in the 80s would have some sort of giveaway.
You have to cut the coupon off the back of the box.
Yeah, so
after you're finished.
He keeps pulling it out, and all the cereal keeps pouring out because for whatever reason, they've also taken all the cereal out of the plastic bag.
I don't think there was a plastic bag back then.
I guess I should ask my mom about that. 3 or 4 different types of cereal are like spilling everywhere. His younger son,
Badger,
is this supposed 8-year-old, and he's just like going to town filling out all these coupons and like mailing them to get all this different type of stuff. In the midst of this, we find out that it's actually really unique for Lane to be awake before noon. It's because he's trying out for the school ski team to impress his girlfriend, Beth, who is this pretty blonde who's been in all the pictures. Lane races downstairs to get in his car, but his dad wants to talk to him about the broken down Camaro that's been just staying there because Lane can't fix it. We cut to the house of his girlfriend, Beth, who is talking to someone on the phone about how she's about to dump Lane for the hunky ski captain of the school team. Lane actually, for being such a loser up to this point in the movie, actually obviously can ski.
Mm-hmm.
And he does a great job on the somewhat difficult course.
Well, and they have to make it in 58 seconds and he made it in a minute. So
yeah, so like even the ski captain is visibly impressed, but he's like, but she missed it. And he's already started to hit on Beth. She dumps Lane for the ski captain, whose name is Stalin, which as a history teacher, I was just disturbed by the whole time.
Me too. I know who Stalin is.
I really have to go nonlinear at this point.
Oh, God.
Because I have missed probably a good 10 side jokes already. And we're like less than 10 minutes in. So I'm going to talk generally about what happens in the movie.
Uh-huh. And you skip over the side gags.
But I just have to. And there's so many scenes that are like interwoven here, mm-hmm. which all are kind of important that you have to make this work, you kind of have to take a step back or we're going to spend 4 hours. For the rest of the movie, Lane just can't catch a break, either from his doing or what people are doing around him. He's depressed, but in a funny way, over losing his girlfriend. Like I said, there's so many sight gags. So one of the scenes is Vincent Schiavelli, who's playing this math teacher who is just talking all sorts of math jargon. The whole class, except for Lane, is completely enraptured. He's making all these math jokes, and everyone's like, oh, ha, 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 ha. So Vincent Schiavella is one of those guys who was in, like,
everything.
Absolutely everything. I'm looking. He's got 163 previous acting roles.
He was in Ghost. He was the angry ghost on the subway who could make things move.
Ah, so I never watched Ghost, but...
What?
But he was in Tomorrow Never Dies and Fast Time at Ridgemont High.
Does that mean we need to watch Ghost?
Dear God, I hope not.
But oh, anyway, we're watching Ghost!
There's a whole bunch of scenes where basically Lane is just metaphorically over his skis the whole time. He just can't seem to catch a break. He has a depressing best friend named Charles DeMar.
It's Booger.
Who's Booger from Revenge of the Nerds, Curtis Armstrong.
He will always be Booger.
Who plays essentially the same character in absolutely every movie.
Booger.
And he's been in high school for 7.5 years, so he knows high school girls. And his brother is absolutely brilliant, but a silent psychopath who, you know, is building things like space lasers and space shuttles and getting books on how to pick up trashy women. He even has, like, the paperboy, which you mentioned earlier, goes full-on enforcer mode. And for whatever reason, just is stalking Lane throughout the entire movie, demanding $2.
I want my $2!
You know, his mom is a ditz. His dad is somewhat trying, but is hopelessly geeky. He has, like, a book of, like... Teen sayings, and he gets them all wrong. Everyone, and I mean everyone, the math teacher, the postman, they keep asking if it'd be okay to start seeing Beth now that he's not seeing her.
Which isn't creepy at all.
Which was especially...
the math teacher.
Because throughout the movie, too, Lane has all these asides of like him kind of like daydreaming / hallucinating. And so I'm like, oh, did the math teacher... really do that, or is he just like imagining it? But later on, the math teacher drives with the top down with Beth in the passenger seat.
Yeah, the car top down.
And gives him the what's up. And then throughout this, like we mentioned, Lane tries to kill himself, but comedically in ways that always go horrendously wrong. What eventually happens is things turn around when he runs into Monique, played by Diane Franklin, who's a French exchange student across the street, who is in an even worse situation than he is. She was brought over to the United States by a really uptight mom who's basically trying to find a girlfriend for her socially completely awkward and geeky, mostly silent son, Ricky, which is played by Dan Schneider.
Dennis, from Head of the Class.
Yes, and the guy who got run out of Nickelodeon TV because of sexual harassment.
Oh, well.
We'll talk about that later. So anyway.
Deeply rooted in this movie.
Ricky is always a step away from Monique.
I love the mom.
The mom.
Ricky's mom.
Ricky!
I love her.
This is all is very much like a Saturday Night Live sketch. Uh-huh. With lots of sight gags. So Monique spends most of the movie acting like she can't speak English because she's hoping that will cause Ricky and the mom to leave her alone because she clearly can't understand or consent to anything. Which, of course, it's the 80s, so you'd be wrong. So the whole movie is basically Ricky one half step away from a grope. But she finally can't take it anymore one night and is throwing lemons at a street sign. She complains to Lane about Ricky, which no one could blame her. And she's like, look, I just came here to see the Brooklyn Dodgers. Which is funny if you're a baseball fan, because the Dodgers had been in L.A. for at least a good decade or two by the time this movie was made.
Yeah, that confused me.
So clearly, she's always been a little smitten with Lane. She has bore her soul to him and says, in English, you're not going to tell him my secret, are you? And Lane is going to say, what, you're a Dodger fan? Lane's bond solidifies with Monique when he's forced to drag race two Asian students, one of which is silent. The other one learned to speak from famous sportscaster Howard Cosell.
I know who that is.
And they crash. And they're safe, but instead of being angry, Monique just laughs, causing Lane to finally lighten up, and he starts laughing too.
Well, they end up in a pond with ducks.
And Ricky in the backseat. And it's not even a pond. It's like there's construction going on. And
there's some ducks
somehow down. There's like water in a ditch in the street. But that's the moment where the movie turns. At school that day, Roy Stalin, the guy who stole his first girlfriend, tries to hit on Monique. He can, of course, speak French, causing Lane to stand up for her.
He doesn't speak French. He says the famous line, "Voulez-vous coucher à mes voix," or whatever, from the song Lady Marmalade.
Oh, he does, huh?
Yeah, that's what he says to her.
Oh, okay.
He doesn't speak French.
All right.
He speaks sexual harassment.
Yes, he does.
The international language.
And so, so unfortunately true. Lane has had enough of Roy Stalin here. So he challenges him to a race, and not just any race, but a ski race down the legendary precarious K-12, which Stalin is the only one who has gone down successfully up to this point. And throughout this movie, Lane has tried to ski down this and always gets about the first drop in and maybe like a slight turn before he falls head over feet just down the rest of the mountain.
You just go really fast that way, and if something gets in your way, you turn.
Exactly. Exactly. I don't understand skiing. That's the advice that both Charles Damar, his best friend, and Monique later gives him on, that's all you do to make that work. There's only a few days to go, and so Monique and Lane are being smitten with each other. Monique helps to improve his skiing. And so the day of the race, they're doing all these kind of like stunt things with...
like going through each other's legs?
Yeah, and turning and stuff like that together.
I mean, it's obviously stunt people with bad wigs, but still.
Exactly. Charles Damar stops them from kissing and says, "Hey, guys, the race is about to start." And so he, of course, runs over one of Lane's skis. I think it's called "The Binding is Broken." Mm-hmm. So he can't attach his boot to the ski. But things get worse. Not only is the race about to start, but suddenly out of nowhere, the paperboy shows up with a bike with skis on it. He starts chasing after Lane. So
I want my $2.
Yeah, wanting his $2. And so Lane, on one ski, is trying to get away. Somehow goes uphill. So he's at the top of K-12.
Not to escape the paperboy.
Roy Stalin, the bully, thinks that Lane has just chickened out. But no, Lane just zooms right past him with one ski down this horribly precarious slope.
That he couldn't do before.
But now
he's on one leg.
Now he's on one ski. And so again,
I wonder if the stunt person was like, "Hey, I can ski on one leg." And they were like, "Cool, we'll ride it." Or if it was written and the stunt person had to learn how to ski with one leg.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think.
And how painful would that be on your leg? One time I went snowboarding and I used my brother's snowboard and he's 6 feet tall. Mm-hmm. So the bindings were for a 6 foot tall person and mm-hmm. I'm not 6 feet tall. Mm-hmm. And so when I put the snowboard on, after about 30 seconds, both my legs were burning off mm-hmm. and I had to keep stopping on the trail and taking the boots off because I couldn't move my legs because they were burning so bad because it hurt because I was basically doing the splits on this thing. And everybody was like, "Just take it to the shop." And I was like, "No, it's too much trouble."
Aww.
It was awful.
So as you'd imagine, on one ski with the paper boy behind him, Lane is not only able to get down the mountain, never falling, but he beats the bully Stalin. And so
he beats Stalin.
He does. And so the crowd at the bottom of the slope goes wild. And of course, Beth is suddenly enamored with Lane again. So she gives Lane a big kiss, who kisses her back, but is just kind of like in the moment, which of course makes Monique upset. Don't worry, it gets worse for her because Ricky and his mom have also come up to the mountain to take her back. As Lane is kind of gets the senses around him and is looking for Monique, he sees her getting dragged away. So he races over and basically says, "Hey, you, get your dang hands off her." It turns into an impromptu sword fight with ski poles. Ridiculously bad.
And you didn't like that fight sequence? It didn't tell a story?
Oh my gosh. So John Cusack gets Ricky down and literally sweeps Monique off her feet and onto his shoulder. And they step into the Camaro, which of course she was a mechanic as well as being bilingual and a perfect skier.
They fixed it.
And apparently
polished it up real nice.
Yeah. They drive off into the sunset, kind of, to Dodger Stadium, right by home plate. They start making out, and as the camera pulls back and we can see it actually is Dodger Stadium, we see this itty bitty bike racing towards the couple. Might as well hear, "I want my $2 as he's racing, and essentially the movie's over. So in general, it is a very dumb movie on purpose. There are so many jokes. The script is incredibly complex, and tons of jokes, which you think are throwaways, often come back to being like key plot points. Mm-hmm. There's just way too much for me to talk about on a podcast.
It's just flying so far.
It's fast. It's like
past you.
It's like you threw spaghetti on the wall just to see what sticks. Once you look at the wall, you're like, oh, that actually is a picture. Not the most beautiful picture, but a lot of stuff is interconnected and so on and so forth. A lot of that can be understood when you realize the writer-director, Savage Steve Holland, which again, since he put Savage in there, you can kind of guess what type of person he is.
He's savage.
Was in his early 20s when he wrote this. And this is about the time of like Fast Times at Richmond High. The movie industry looked at that movie and said, oh, crap, we need more movies like this. And so Savage Steve was like, hey, I got a movie for you. The thing is that he's basically a Protestant Woody Allen. All these horrible things happened to him. The way he got discovered is he made a movie about his like 13th birthday party and like no one shows up. I think except for like a drunk clown or something like that.
I mean.
And he thought it was just a really sad movie. Uh-huh. And Henry Winkler was like, that's hilarious. Do you have any other sad stories from your past which are hilarious? And he's like, well, and you have Better Off. Debt. Uh-huh. But it's very much just the fever dream of any teenage boy. The main character is clearly the writer, and he looks like John Cusack, but he's a loser. But he has tons of potential if he would only get out of his way. One of the germs of this movie was that his girlfriend dumped him for the captain of the ski team, and he got really depressed and he wanted to kill himself. So evidently what he did is he hooked up a hose to hang himself, but he was standing on a plastic trash can. And so what happened was he was like, you know what, I really don't want to do this. And as he was thinking that, the plastic trash can, the top crumpled. So he's in his garage with a plastic hose around his neck. He's fallen through the lid of the plastic garbage can. He is stuck in that garbage can in a way he can't get out. And the pipe is pouring water on his face, and his mom races into the garage and just starts yelling at him because she doesn't realize he just tried to commit suicide. He's just, you know, messed up the garage. And so she waits a while to save him from drowning because she doesn't realize that he's drowning because of this. So he's had that type of life. So of course, in the movie, he has this beautiful, perfect French girlfriend who just loves him just because, and is willing to look past the fact he's a loser and just, you know, and she's perfect in everything she does. And so this type of trope is very normal for teenage boys. Like today it's like, oh yeah, where's my girlfriend who's just like super cute, an hourglass, and you know, she plays video games, but not too much. And she's into anime, but she doesn't know as much as me. And she loves me, even though I'm a loser. That daydream is very prevalent. It's just the 80s version of it. A roundabout way to say that John Cusack basically saves it because he is just so effortlessly cool. Uh-huh. Like even when he's pathetic and depressed, uh-huh, he's still cool. He's not say anything cool, but it's the same type of thing.
The Lloyd Dobler effect.
Essentially, one of the things that's kind of important to ask, like whenever you're watching a movie that's 40 years old, essentially, would
number
that
one, how dare you?
So the big question is, could you make this movie today?
No.
or could you update it? And yes, no, a resounding no.
Sorry.
You know, the whole suicide thing.
Did I steal your thunder?
No, it's okay. It's everybody up to this point will be saying the same thing. It's a little xenophobic, but not by 80s terms, not that bad.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, not their fault, but Daniel Schneider playing a guy who's sexually harassing a woman, to watch him
manhandle.
Yeah, kind of manhandle and force himself on a woman once after he gets forced out of Nickelodeon. He doesn't admit to any wrongdoing, and Nickelodeon says, no, he didn't do anything wrong. But when you listen to some of the Nickelodeon stars, clearly sexual harassment, like spa parties. And like no parents allowed.
Do you mean like a jacuzzi spa party or like
jacuzzi like spa party. Like oh, like the kids who would get in the hot tub with Dan and others would get better parts and like trying to see how. Yeah, and again, and some of them to this day are still scarred and will tell everybody how scarred they are. So anyway, anything that he's in is just like, ugh. But yeah, this is very 80s movie. We're in high school, but everyone is clearly at least 28.
I was thinking about that when in the math class scene. I was like, because I remember you always say that in the 80s, like they cast like 30-year-olds and they all look like they're 30.
Oh, yeah.
What would your final rating be?
Well, my final rating to this would be a thumb in the middle and a thumbs down.
Okay.
So.
Well, I thought you were going to say two thumbs down, so.
No. If you go into the movie thinking it's an actual movie, then you will be horrendously disappointed. And you will act like John Cusack did when he saw that screening.
You'll storm out and say, never speak to me again?
Yes. And why are you forcing me to watch this? I will never trust you. So,
oh, end of podcast.
But it's, but if you get through that and you understand, no, I'm not watching a movie. I'm watching a teenager.
It's an experience.
Throw as many jokes on the wall as they can. It's so ridiculous, super quotable.
It's in the zeitgeist.
It's like the Big Lebowski, where like the first time you're like, I don't know why I paid money for this movie. And then if you keep watching it.
And you watch it 30 more times.
Once you say, okay, I accept that this movie is happening and I'm just going to get the enjoyment out of it that I can. It's like, I understand why.
Then you're walking into people's houses and going, that rug really tied the room together.
Yeah. I can see it being your kind of movie. Not necessarily my type of movie, but it's like, if it was just playing on TV in the background, I wouldn't get up to change the channel.
You would clean your house to it.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, no. We don't clean this house.
Wow.
We've cleaned this house 18 times today, and it looks like this.
Yeah. I think our apartment is alive. It's very upset that we live here, and I feel like we're like
it's trying to chase
the
us
disease,
out.
And like the clutter is white blood cells trying to get us out. So one of the things that I love about doing these movies is doing quotes. A movie like this lends itself to quotes.
Oh yeah.
So we'll see how this goes. So we already did the first one, which was, what was the advice on how to do K-12?
So, go really fast that way, and if something gets in your way, you turn.
Okay. So when Lane stands up to Monique against the bully, he says, "She only speaks French, Roy. She doesn't."
Idiot.
Speak imbecile. There you go. I'll take it. And then there are four things that Lane's mom tries to fix for dinner when they have Ricky and the mom and Monique the French girl over. What are the four things?
Oh, French fries.
Mm-hmm, that's one.
French bread.
Uh-huh.
French dressing.
Uh-huh. And to drink, ta-da, we have
champagne.
Mm-mm. Peru. Because it was Perrier.
Peru.
There you go. Very well done. I can say you are a certified fan of Better Off Dead.
Thank you. I know that I'm kind of stomping all over our format, but I just have to angrily come out and just ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like this movie? I guess it's just my way of asking, did this movie hold up for you?
I saw it just at the age where you start to be very self-aware of what's cool and what's not cool. Like Ghostbusters, which came out on the same day. You were not allowed not to like that movie with my friend group. Everyone loved Gremlins. Everyone loved Ghostbusters. And there are so many things wrong with this movie. But yet, I still really liked it. It's a good turn-your-brain-off movie.
Is it?
To be honest, I was like 50-50. We were going to be able to get through Gremlins. I was not overly confident. So my long-winded answer is yes, it's a movie that I should not like, but I like, and it's a guilty pleasure, and yeah, go Gremlins.
Okay, well, let's see if I agree. would you like to hear my pitch?
Would love to.
When a clueless inventor gives his son a perilous present, it's alliteration, for Christmas, the whole town falls under attack on Christmas Eve.
By the Gremlins.
So, his name is Pelter, and he's got a story to tell.
Mm-hmm.
So, we open in Chinatown, or a Chinatown. I couldn't quite tell the time period until we meet a little boy who is bringing Pelter down to his grandfather's shop. Pelter says that he's in the shop looking for a present, but then he starts to pitch an as-seen-on-TV-style invention to the old shop owner. And I was like, yeah, like the old Asian man is going to start selling your oversized Swiss army knife in his antique store. So Pelter hears something singing, and he discovers an antique box with a creature inside, and it's a mogwai, which I don't know if you know this, but means devil in Cantonese. No big deal.
Did not know that.
He immediately starts shoving hundreds at the shopkeeper because it's a perfect gift for his son. And I was like, is his son 8? Nope. He's a 20-something man who drags his dog Barney, played brilliantly by the very talented Mushroom, and who I'm just going to say right now is the best actor in this whole mess.
Absolutely. If there were Oscars for animals, mushroom would be enshrined just from this one performance.
So good.
So well done.
For some reason, he drags his dog to work every day, but we'll get to that in a minute.
Already off the rails.
Well, it's already off
already the rails. Completely off
Sorry.
The rails.
Back to the shopkeep.
Yes.
Sorry. He or she is a very talented actor.
Oh, incredible.
Like, the performance was nuanced.
Like, controlled the scenes they were supposed to control, but were very supportive.
Right.
And without stealing the show. So if you're, like, watching the dog.
Right.
Like, always on point.
Always.
But doesn't steal the spotlight.
The action
unless it was supposed to.
And reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Just, wow.
Amazing.
With an amazing scene partner.
I know.
Can we just talk about Mushroom all day?
I think so. You know, don't work with kids or animals unless it's Mushroom. And then get ready for your Oscar.
He's just going to elevate the performance.
Yeah.
So anyway, we got to go back to the backtrack. So the shopkeeper refuses to sell the Mogwai to Peltzer, saying that it comes with great responsibility. But when he leaves the room, the grandson sells it to him on the down low because they need the money. But there are three important rules that must be followed. Number one, keep it out of bright light. And matter of fact, sunlight can kill it, which almost is given as an afterthought. These are very important rules. I don't, like, why is he not telling him, write this down? Like, it's just so carelessly given. Rule two is don't give it water or get it wet. And do not feed it after midnight. And Peltzer's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, to have the confidence of a mediocre white man.
No argument.
Cut to what is called, Kingston Falls, a.k.a. the Back to the Future set. Once I realized that it was the Back to the Future set, I couldn't unrealize it, and I just started wishing that I was watching Back to the Future. By the way, can I just tell you, I almost forgot to say this. This movie gave me a nightmare.
Aww.
Yeah, that I decided to quit working at the school that I'm working at,
mm-hmm.
and go work at another school. And mm-hmm. then I realized what I had done, and I started panicking, and I called my boss and I begged her to take me back.
Aww.
That was the nightmare that I had because of this movie.
That has nothing to do with this movie.
Gave me a nightmare.
Okay.
So we meet Billy, who is played by Zach Galligan. So he's trying to start his VW Bug, but the engine is frozen because it's been snowing. And I just want to say that if this was filmed at the Back to the Future set, which was Universal Studios, the snow was not real. So their snow budget must have been massive.
At least half the budget is snow budget, because you are absolutely correct. There is snow everywhere and at all times.
And it looks so cold.
It does.
I don't know how they made it look all, like, foggy and frosty, too. Anyway. What are we talking about? Oh, this terrible movie. Sorry. I mean, this movie that you don't know yet if I like or not like. So then we meet the xenophobic Mr. Futterman, who is a snowplow operator who goes off about foreign-made cars. Billy kindly extricates himself by saying, oh, I better get to work because I'm late. And then he, like, walks 2 blocks with his dog, no leash, to the bank. His dog just sits under the counter all day, and nobody's noticed so far except for the town Miss Gulch. She's the dog-hating, mean lady from Wizard of Oz.
Okay.
I drew a parallel.
Oh, wow.
Her name's Mrs. Deagle, and she's played by the Kiss My Grits lady, Polly Holiday. She's storming down the street holding the head of Frosty.
Just in case you didn't know she was the bad guy, she literally is carrying the decapitated head of Frosty the Snowman.
So she cuts in line to yell at Billy because his dog supposedly broke her Frosty statue, which doesn't make any sense because she hates everything Christmas, we find out later. And Barney has been with Billy all morning long.
Well, it does later to me because she's a cat person, so clearly she's psycho.
She's awful.
Yes, she's awful.
So she threatens that she's going to take Billy's dog and put it to sleep. And Barney hears this, and he understands English because he's an amazing... He's studied.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you, this dog studied.
Mm-hmm.
Classically.
Mm-hmm.
So he launches over the counter at her, and then everyone now notices that Billy brings his dog to work with him every day.
Well, number one, never shortchange Mushroom, who not only manages to untie themselves.
Right.
And we get to see this work of, like, Houdini level artistry.
Right.
And
he knows knots too.
And everyone loves Mushroom. Everyone loves Barney the dog because, like, all the other tellers see it and they're like, oh, okay, yeah, here comes Billy with the dog. And I'm just like, what is going on?
Maybe they're just turning a blind eye.
Absolutely. Well, because it's Barney. I mean, it's Mushroom. It's like acting royalty. Like, so of course.
Move aside.
Yeah.
Well, he expertly launches in a stunt coordinated. Did you like that fight? Did that fight tell a story?
I thought it was amazing.
Because he was, like, at her, but he didn't harm her. But he was, like, showed her.
showed dominance. Like, it was a sublime performance.
Billy is then scolded by the bank manager and then the junior bank manager, supposedly a 23-year-old Judge Reinhold.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, 23? Him? Side note, I've always wondered if his name was actually Judge. So you might want to fast forward this if you don't want to be disappointed. Mm-hmm. His name's actually Edward. And his dad nicknamed him Judge when he was 2 weeks old.
Well, it makes sense because he looks, I'm pretty sure he was buying beer like in sixth grade.
The only person who is nice to Billy is Kate, played by Phoebe Cates. Just a little trivia in case you were hiding under a rock. Phoebe Cates and Judge Reinhold were in Fast Times at Ridgemont High together. So we learn that the people of this town have kind of fallen on hard times. Billy is hanging out at Dory's bar after work. And we learn that Kate is the new waitress. And she's volunteered to be the new waitress so that Dory doesn't have to pay somebody. Mm-hmm. So she's working for free. Judge Reinhold shows up. And he taunts Billy about almost being fired that day. And he starts bragging about how much he has accomplished at age 23. And he invites Kate to come by his place. And then about his apartment, he says, "Hey, Kate, you haven't seen my new apartment." To which she fires back,
"I haven't been to the old apartment."
But he sweetens up the deal with,
"We're talking VHS tapes, is that?"
Cable.
We're talking cable here. Which is why Judge doesn't get lucky in this movie, nor Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
We're
it's because he has that level of game.
So we cut to Billy's home, and when he shuts the front door upon entering, there is a running gag of there's like the two swords. What's it called? A samurai sword. I don't know.
Let's take a moment. So they're clearly. European style.
Oh, sorry.
There's like a crest.
I thought they were samurai swords.
They're clearly not samurai swords. They're clearly medieval style broadswords. So
I'm sorry that I don't know swords. What are we talking about?
Anything but this movie.
Yeah. So the swords. Mm-hmm. So there's these two medieval broadswords, lances. Mm-hmm. On the crisscrossed on the wall, like how people used to decorate. And every time someone comes in the house and closes the door, one of the swords falls off the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So he, you know, very much like, oh, this happens every day, like replaces the sword. And then we meet his mom, who coincidentally has the same haircut as her son. The mom is played by Frances Lee McMahon, who coincidentally played Lorraine Baines McFly's mom. In Back to the Future.
Steven Spielberg. Yeah, he's the producer of this movie.
Oh, that's why.
Okay. Like every producer and director, if you're paying attention, yeah, they have their peeps, whether it be actors and especially behind the scenes. So.
One day I want to be someone's peep.
I want to be a peep.
So she's making dinner, and Billy helps her, assisted by one of the many defective kitchen gadgets that his father invented. And then Dad arrives, puts the sword back on the wall because it falls off again, and announces that he's got a Christmas present for Billy. So Billy thinks it's another dog. And both of us were like, hello, Barney's the, excuse you.
Like you're ever going to do better than Barney. I mean, come on now.
So he opens the box. Out pops a cute little creature that Peltzer has named Gizmo. So Daddy Peltzer almost forgets, but recites the rules to Billy about how to care for Gizmo. So Billy takes Gizmo upstairs and begins to unintentionally maim him. He shows him a mirror. What? Don't make that face. He does all this stuff. He's like so careless. He hurts him like 5 times and within like a half hour. It's ridiculous. He like shows him a mirror and the light flashes and Gizmo's like, ah! And then he falls in the trash can and like cracks his head open. So he pulls him out of the trash can. I was like, I don't think Billy is responsible enough to have this pet, let alone Barney. Like, how is Barney alive still? Because Barney can take care of himself.
Mm-hmm. And he's carrying this movie.
He is carrying this movie. So the next day, little Corey Feldman, dressed up like a Christmas tree, swings the door open and delivers a Christmas tree to the Peltzer house. He has interrupted Billy, who is attempting to make orange juice with another malfunctioning device created by his dad. Orange juice is in the process of spraying all over the kitchen. And little Corey Feldman says about buying orange juice,
"You should just buy it by the carton. It's a lot easier.
You should just buy orange juice in a carton. It's easier." Then the machine goes. So Billy shows little Corey Feldman Gizmo, and they immediately spill water on him. And as they ignore Gizmo, who is screaming and writhing in pain, they're just like ignoring him.
Well, that's because like little fur balls have popped off.
But he is. The first thing I would do would be like, oh my God, are you okay? He's screaming and writhing, and they're just like staring at the little balls that pop off. So yeah, as you say, the little fur balls pop off of him and they turn into more little gizmos.
Yeah, just like off his back. So there's like little, these little puffs of fur.
Yeah, and don't worry about him. He's just screaming in pain. So one of them they call Stripe because he has a stripe. The copies are a little off. They're not sweet and cuddly like Gizmo. They're very like mischievous and they're kind of jerks. Billy shows his dad, and of course Mr. Peltzer immediately sees dollar signs. He bets every kid in America would like a pet like that. They may even replace the family dog, to which we both were like, excuse me, again, you have the best dog ever.
Mm-hmm.
That night, Billy puts Gizmo and the copies to bed, but he wakes up in the middle of the night to Barney whining. Now, at this point, I say, does anything happen to the dog? Mm-hmm. And you didn't remember, so we had to pause the movie, and then you did like a 20-minute research.
Yeah, you of course go to the, we are not sponsored, but... DidTheDogDie.com.
Yes. I was like, is of course where you go. I said, you need to check the website. Unfortunately, we discover that it's probably fine. Fortunately, the dog got to go on vacation for the duration of the film. So good for Barney. Not so good for me. So Barney is inexplicably found hanging off of the porch from Christmas lights. And he got a little cold, but he's otherwise fine. And they wonder if the culprit was Mrs. Deagle. So they decide that Barney should probably go on vacation to Grandma's house for a while. So Billy takes one of the copies to his old high school science teacher?
Oh, elementary school, I think is what I read.
Really?
Yeah, well, at first it was a much darker movie.
Yes.
And much more bloody. And then the other thing that happened, which they didn't fix with the script because it was the 80s, and who cares?
No one will notice.
Was they significantly aged up the Billy character. So originally he was a middle schooler.
Oh, that explains why I was like, and so, is Billy 8?
Which kind of more explains why you would get a little pet for him in the first place.
So anyway, Mr. Hansen asks if he can keep one of the copies. And Billy says,
sure.
I can spare one.
Oh, there you go. I think I can spare one.
We cut to Mr. Futterman getting cut off at the bar by Kate. And he's going on and on and on about foreigners. And he climbs into his snowplow and he's rambling about gremlins, which are creatures from World War II that would get into machines and wreak havoc. And I was like, you're letting this man drive drunk home in a snowplow? But then at the last second, Kate's like, you know, you should probably walk home. And absolutely not true to life, Mr. Futterman agrees.
Yes.
And doesn't fight with her and call her the B word.
Of course, true to the 80s, women are seen as intelligent and wise.
Yeah, and it's only like two blocks because, you know.
It's the Back to the Future set. So everyone lives within two blocks.
Yeah. So Billy's like super impressed with the way she handled Futterman. Then is shocked at the revelation that not everybody loves the holidays, Kate included, because he says to her, as if this is good enough reason, what's not to like? I mean, it's a lot of fun.
Yes, to be a mediocre young white man, maybe.
At that point, I almost got up and just left. I was like, I can't with this movie. But he seems to forgive her, and he asks her on a date, and she accepts. She likes him.
Oh, Phoebe.
Oh, Phoebe Cates, who's married to Kevin Kline, who's mm-hmm. the best mushroom.
Kevin Kline, who's the mushroom of the human acting world.
I mean... the gravitas.
Yes.
Meanwhile, Mr. Hansen is busy pissing off the Gizmo copy by taking his blood. I have never seen blood taken this way, and I would be pissed off as well. So Billy is home late that night, and the Gizmo copies are acting crazy. And Billy looks over at the clock, and he decides that he should probably be able to give them some leftover chicken from the fridge, which you were like, that is a lot of leftover chicken.
It was a ton. It was like...
a full-on plate. Like, it probably was their dinner for the next day. I don't think it was leftovers.
Oh, for the week.
So he offers Gizmo some, and thankfully Gizmo isn't hungry. He's too busy watching TV. The copies gobble up the chicken wings, and the next morning they have turned into a disgusting, oozing blob, which Mr. Hansen recognizes as a pupa, or a cocoon, like a butterfly.
The copy that the science teacher has also... managed to grab some sandwich like after midnight as well. So all the Mogwai except for Gizmo are now in these horrible looking pods.
Billy realizes later that the power cord on his clock radio had been chewed through and the clock stopped at around 11:45 the previous evening, and that he actually fed them closer to 2 a.m., which we know because Mr. Hansen, I don't know if he was at home or in his school lab still, but it was like 2 a.m. and he was eating a sandwich and he's like, oh, call it a night. And he clicks the lights off like he's going to go sleep under his desk or something.
Yeah, it was like, it was weird.
I was like, is he living at school? What's happening? Why is he there until 2 a.m.? So Billy's dad calls from a science-y convention, an invention convention. Mm-hmm. To let his wife know that he's probably going to be late for Christmas because he's trying to hawk his wares and make money for the family. So cut to the last day before break in Mr. Hansen's class, and he is, of course, showing a movie, albeit a science-y one. We made hot chocolate and watched Noel, and then the next day we made popcorn and watched Home Alone 2 in my classroom. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, what teacher doesn't show a movie on the last day of school? Like, why do we even have the last day? Because no one's paying attention. Everyone's nuts. Mm-hmm. Were your kids nuts? Oh, the years were taking finals.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, in elementary school.
I teach to the end.
Bell to bell instruction.
Exactly.
None of this Miss Hammond crap where she vamps for 30 minutes.
I'm a natural teacher. I am not a natural cool teacher. So I'm instructing the whole time. So I don't have your personality or the other teaching personality, which is like, oh, hey, I'm cool. So just do what I say.
I'm going to turn my chair backwards and rap with you.
Yeah, just hang out, guys.
Hey, you guys need to pick up all the trash on the floor. There's a magic piece of trash, and I'll let you know when the person who picks up the magic piece of trash picks it up, and they win. And if you ask me, is this it, you are disqualified. Okay, go.
Wow. That was like, if Mushroom was a teacher, that would be something he would do. That was Mushroom-esque.
Thank you.
Level of teaching right there.
Something. What are we talking about?
Anything about this movie.
Oh, wait. So right before the bell rings, the box starts smoking and it tosses itself off of the counter. And then the bell rings. So he shoos all the children out and he goes to call Billy and let him know that the cocoon has hatched. And he goes back in the classroom and the creature, we don't know what it looks like yet, is like loose in the classroom. And so he tries to coax it out from under the desk so we can see what it looks like. And then, we don't see what happens because it's PG. Mm-hmm. So the creatures in Billy's attic at the same time are hatching and they start terrorizing Gizmo and Billy's mom at the house. So Billy arrives at school to find Mr. Hansen dead on the floor with a syringe sticking out of his butt cheek as retribution for stabbing the creature with the same needle earlier, I would imagine.
And can you blame him?
No, I can't. A panicked Billy calls his mom and tries to warn her to get out of the house. Billy's mom proceeds to juice, stab, and microwave all but one of the now demonic gremlins. Billy runs home to find his mom being choked by Stripe. He takes the loose sword off the wall and tries to stab him, but he escapes. And so now Stripe and the one, I think at school, are unleashed on the town. So Billy finds a terrified Gizmo trapped in the laundry chute. Billy takes his scratched up mother to the doctor's house, and he sets off to find Stripe. He follows footprints in the snow, and I was like, isn't snow water?
Absolutely.
To the local YMCA, where Stripe swan dives into the pool. About 1,000 gremlins start climbing out of the pool water. So the gremlins set off to terrorize the town. The Futtermans are run down in their living room by their American-made snowplow. And apparently the gremlins are natural electricians because they rewire Mrs. Deagle's stair chair to operate at about 60 miles an hour, and it launches her out her attic window.
Yeah. The idea of a gremlin actually is a really modern invention. As people get upset with technology, they were saying, well, you know, whenever any sort of machine would act up, it was like, oh, it's a gremlin that's like playing with the machine. And
I mean, this film is really a treatise against technology, if you think about it.
I mean, at the very end, if you didn't know what the theme was.
Technology's bad?
No.
Oh.
No.
This movie's bad?
No.
Oh.
No. At the very end. I can't say it without spoiling.
Oh, don't spoil.
But once we get there, it's like, literally they say the theme of the movie out loud.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. And he's right. Mm-hmm. So Billy runs to the police station where the sheriff and his drunk sidekick don't believe a word, he says. And then the town starts calling about all sorts of freak accidents. So a group of gremlins take over the bar and they're terrorizing Kate, but not before they stop off apparently at the Halloween spirit store to pick up some costumes.
Yeah, a lot of very well tailored clothing.
Miami Vice costume. Mm-hmm. There was a lady gremlin with earrings.
Yeah, a gremlin that flashes.
I'm laughing. Why am I laughing? They're all smoking and drinking, and I was like, doesn't a drink have water in it?
Mm-hmm. That's one of the huge issues with this movie, is like the rules do not make sense.
No, they don't apply. So Kate realizes the creatures are scared of light when she tries to light one of its cigarettes. So she grabs a camera with the old-fashioned flash bulb, and she starts flashing them, flash bulbing them, yep. Not flashing them like the gremlin.
Yeah,
she's Polaroid. Flash bulbing them. Polaroid, that's what it's called. And then she runs out of those, but luckily Billy has been able to get his VW bug to start, and he shows up and he shines his headlights into the bar. So Kate runs out of the door, jumps in the car. Billy shows her gizmo, and they run to the bank for shelter. And this is where we hear the worst Why I Hate Christmas story I have ever heard in my life. She hates Christmas because her dad died stuck in a chimney on Christmas Eve dressed as Santa. They didn't find him until 4 days later when they tried to use the fireplace. And the worst line of the movie is, and that's how...
I found out there's no Santa Claus.
That's how I discovered the truth about Santa Claus.
I mean, sweet, sweet Phoebe does about as good with that monologue as you can.
She tried to mushroom.
But she tried to mushroom.
Mushroom probably would have given it.
Oh, mushroom would have landed it as a 10, and it would have been what they showed at the Academy Awards when they were showing like his...
For the acceptance speech?
Yeah, but that scene, multiple times they tried to cut it out of the movie, and the writer-director just refused. Dante refused to, because he said it was the movie, which that's your sign. You need to let go of a scene when you say that scene is the movie. It's kind of funny, but it's kind of sad, and she's trying to be serious with it. And even Spielberg has said, I wanted to cut, but of course you don't use that monologue. It's a horrible monologue. Doesn't make sense.
I don't know, Keith. I'm going to use it for my next audition.
You should. Spielberg today, I think, would have said.
No.
Yeah.
Mushroom says cut it.
Yeah. Oh, that's all you would need. Mushroom was not on set during this time. Because no, Mushroom, Mushroom would have set down his cigarette and whispered to the director, that needs to go.
So things quiet down, and Billy thinks that the gremlins have probably found a dark place to hang out at while the sun comes up. So they wander into a movie theater, and they find all the gremlins have settled in to catch a showing of Snow White. So Billy asks Kate where the boiler room is. I was like, why? Is she an expert in building schematics? So they find it, and Billy opens up the gas valve, and he lights it like a fabric and on fire, and they escape. And the building blows up, killing all the gremlins inside, but not Stripe, who had a hankering for milk duds and apparently can read, takes a walk to the Montgomery Ward across the street to grab some candy. So Billy and Kate chase after him. And since Kate is the building expert, she gets to go up to the office to try to turn all the lights on.
Yeah, Billy's like, yeah, go find the power grid.
You know what? Billy is a feminist. Mm-hmm. So Billy tries to go find Stripe. So... At this time, my brain is scrambled. So Peltzer Sr. shows up with Barney, and somehow they end up at the Montgomery Ward. I don't remember how that happened. I don't really care. Is this over yet? Is what I was thinking, as in my notes. Mm-hmm. So Gizmo jumps into a Barbie car and tries to lure Stripe into the garden center where there's a skylight. Kate is having a real hard time finding the light switch.
But she gets into like the back office and finds it eventually.
The light switch. Billy's being attacked by Stripe with a chainsaw. Barney is acting his face off. Kate finally gets the lights on, but then this also causes the fountain in the garden center to start running. And so Stripe is like, water! So he runs over and he sticks his finger in the water. And he's about to generate more copies when Gizmo opens the skylight and the sun fries him like bacon. Not only does the sunlight burn him to death, but it also causes him to degenerate into a pool of goo, which, again, Mushroom really gives gravitas to that scene.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it's just, you can feel the sense of mourning and loss and relief and just shaking his head at life and...
Yeah, the fleetingness of life and how we're all here. But for a moment before we return to vapor into the afterlife.
Maybe that would be the scene they would show at his Oscar acceptance speech.
Oh, no. He would have landed Santa Claus. He would have.
So later, everyone's regrouped at the Peltzer home, and the news is going crazy over the Kingston Falls night of freak accidents and tragedy. I'm not going to go into it, but I was like, oh my God, like he's lucky they didn't have video cameras everywhere back then, because Billy would totally be in trouble for blowing stuff up. That would have been a dystopian horror movie. Mm-hmm. No, actually, it wouldn't be dystopian, because dystopian is everything goes back to the way it was. But, like, everyone thinking, like, he was trying. No, actually, it would, because he'd be like, no, this thing is happening, and nobody believes him, and then he gets in trouble for it. That I think that treads the line of dystopian fiction.
And then the evil continues.
And the evil continues, yes. So the shopkeeper, whose name is Mr. Wing, shows up to take Gizmo back and is horrified to see that he has turned into a couch potato. And he says,
"You taught him how to watch TV?"
Basically scolds them for being irresponsible and the American culture for being careless with things of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, he's not wrong.
There's the theme.
Gizmo says goodbye, and Mr. Wing apparently walks all the way back to Chinatown. Is there a Chinatown in Kingston Falls?
So I'm guessing we were supposed to believe that he...
Is he a mythical creature?
New York City. Well, there's so much we could get into here.
Maybe Chinatown's two blocks away.
Well, what's interesting is they screwed up the shot originally. And so he's just walking and then disappeared in the original shot. And they almost kept that to be...
Please.
I know. I think that would have been a better way to
end it. What the heck?
Yeah.
Because now I'm angry. As you said before, the original version was a lot darker, and the gremlins end up murdering the mom and Barney.
How dare they?
So thank God that didn't happen. Gizmo was supposed to turn into Stripe, but Spielberg wanted him to be cute and cuddly the whole way through, so he could probably sell Gizmo dolls.
Yeah, which I think is the right call.
Oh yeah, no one wants to see that. The man who played Mr. Wing, his name is Key Luke.
Mm-hmm.
He was like 80 at the time, but he had such a young looking appearance that they had to age him up with makeup, and they probably gave him that gross eyeball.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what moisturizer are you using? And I tell Isla every morning, it is never too early to start moisturizing. Aging is hard. Moisturize. Anyway, did you know that they tried to originally use monkeys as the gremlins, but the monkey freaked out when they put the gremlin head on, so they were like, oh, okay, no.
Yeah, evidently the monkeys destroyed the set and threw poop everywhere. So,
good on them.
I know.
They tried to warn you.
Evidently they looked at the script, but...
Do you want to know how I feel about this movie?
Yes, how do you feel about this movie?
Well, unlike Mushroom, I am not able to conceal. I hated it. I didn't think it was funny. I was confused by the rules most of the time. I hated the gremlins. I was not entertained by their silly little costumes and their antics. I just wanted it to be over. However, I did think it was sweet that Billy and the mom did put up with Peltzer and his ridiculous gadgets. They really try to support him and use all the crap that he's re-engineered. The only thing
I mention you're the mushroom of film criticism?
Thank you. I know. The only thing that made about 5 minutes of this movie watchable was, again, I have it in my notes, the great actor Mushroom the dog. And I said in my notes, just, do they give Oscars to dogs? But unfortunately, even Mushroom can't save this pool of ooze for me. So I rate this movie 2 microwaved gremlins. 2 thumbs down. It's down. 2 thumbs down.
All right.
Did you know that I hated this movie?
Oh, clearly.
How'd you know?
Oh, the eye rolls, the sighs of exasperation, the angry writing on the clipboard. The crossed arms.
Sorry.
It's okay. We're talking cable.
Why don't you just write a good movie? It's easier.
Wow. This is why we have the podcast.
Why is that?
2 movies that we liked and the other one hated. Usually we're like, oh, we don't like the same movies. And then normally we have this... Like, oh, it's not that bad. And it's all positive, and you can hear the change in our tastes, which is the big problem. When people start reviewing stuff, over time, they start having the same taste.
Not us.
I'm telling you, this goes to the core.
The gloves have been thrown down.
Exactly.
The medieval broadsword and gauntlet has been tossed down.
Not the samurai sword. I still think it was fun. It was still fun to watch the movies. And
yeah, I mean, I hated Gremlins. I didn't feel like I was ever going to get through it, but. But once I was reviewing it, I was making myself laugh.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I had to turn the corner too with Better Off Dead.
You're a better person than me.
Aww. So What are we going to do next,
Okay, Lori? We promise that this time we are going to do it. So we recently went on a, God, it was 6 months ago now. We went on a trip and we took a train and we went with your parents. And your dad full on reminded me of one of the characters from Darjeeling Limited. So we have to watch it so that I can show you. Because I love that movie. Because I love Wes Anderson. And it's basically Wes Anderson on a train. And what are you making me watch?
I'm going to make you watch The Brothers Bloom, which is another one-hitter quitter for me. But okay. I think it does have the man with kind eyes, Mark Ruffalo.
Oh, it does?
It does.
Oh, that's right. I knew that.
And so it's a crime movie. So, but it's got Rachel Weisz as well, who I know you also like.
I do.
Not as much as Mark Ruffalo.
No. But I love The Broadster.
Adrian Brody and Mark Ruffalo play the Brothers Bloom.
Okay. Well, so. Okay. Right. Yeah, we're going to do that.
Well, thank you so much for listening.
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
And Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas.
Yes, that was insisted by our assistant.
Who will not record it.
Our daughter, the mushroom of children, insisted that we say Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. Mm-hmm. So listen to us anywhere you hear podcasts and give us reviews.
Rate and review, please. On Apple Podcasts specifically. Yeah, we have a Facebook page. We have an Instagram page. He Saw, She Saw, or He Saw, She Saw podcast. It's somewhere. Just look up He Saw, She Saw. It's a picture of us in the mannequin movie pose with the motorcycle and the mannequin. So if you see a motorcycle and a mannequin with our faces on it, that is it.
That is us. Because it's not chat, because they're not chatting back to us.
Exactly. Because you were talking at them.
So we'll talk to you next year.
We'll talk at you next year.
2024, baby.
I hope it's the mushroom of years.
Merry Christmas.